just in terms of review, we're finishing up the Old Testament background prior to the intertestamental period. We've covered the return from exile, the rebuilding of the temple. Last week we looked at some of the events that happened during the period of Esther. And we just had gotten into the what's titled here on the outline, Final Events. So last week we talked about Ezra's return to Jerusalem, and remember that although a lot of the period of the return from exile and the rebuilding of the temple and things after that are recorded in Ezra, Ezra wasn't actually there until later, in some 70 to 80 years later. And he came back to teach the law, if you remember, under King Artaxerxes, the Persian ruler Artaxerxes. And then about 13 years after that, Nehemiah returned to the land to rebuild the walls, also under the Persian king Artaxerxes. And so we had just talked last week about Nehemiah's return, some of the things that he accomplished after the return. And you remember one of the big emphases of Nehemiah's time was really ethical and returning to the principles and the obedience to the law that the people in the land had neglected. And we looked at things last week just briefly about things like putting a stop to the oppression of the poor that was going on. We see a strong emphasis on Nehemiah's concern for the poor. And then a recommitment to the law. You remember that scene where they build a platform and Ezra reads the law in the court. That's recorded in Nehemiah chapters 8 through 10. And so being reacquainted with the law. And you remember the story about the Levites really rallying around Ezra and Nehemiah there and teaching the law to the people during those times when they were reading the law publicly. And then, of course, we see the rededication of the walls and the reestablishment of worship in the city. Now, that's not how the Old Testament ends. Nehemiah actually didn't stay there. He was recalled to Persia. You remember, we talked about this last week, that he set a time for his return. When he asked permission to go, Artaxerxes asked him, "How long will you be gone?" And I think that the words in the Bible, he says, "It pleased him to send me, so I set a time." So he set a time, and we don't know what that time was, but we do know that about 12 years later, he was called back to Persia, and this was in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, which would have been about 432 B.C., If you look on your table there, you can see the approximate date there when Nehemiah returned to Persia. Now, at the end of the book of Nehemiah, in chapter 13, we read about what happened after he returned to Persia. And it's really not a pretty picture. In his absence, the people quickly reverted back to their old ways. And we learn about this because in chapter 13, Nehemiah again returned to Jerusalem, and he found everything in a state of disarray again. We don't know exactly when that was. We just know it was at a later date, obviously. But when he comes back, some of the things that he needed to do was he needed to cleanse the temple of outsiders. You remember that one of the enemies of the people had actually gotten a room inside the temple court. So he had to cleanse the temple. The words in the Bible, he says that he took all of his stuff and threw it out, basically. Cleaned it out and threw it out, sort of like being evicted from a house. He had to reestablish the tithe for the Levites again. He had to reestablish the Sabbath. Remember that people from outside the city were coming in and selling their wares on the Sabbath. So you remember the story where he commanded that the gates be closed on Friday evening and not opened again until after the Sabbath was over. And that the funny story, there's sort of a funny story there where the people then just camped outside the gates as if they were going to be able to get in somehow. And I love the language there, the language that sticks with you where he says he's going to lay hands on them if they do that again. And so they stopped doing it. He also had to correct intermarriage violations again. Remember that that's one of the emphases that Ezra had when Ezra returned. They had to recommit to not intermarrying with the pagan people of the land. And when I was reading this and thinking about just, you know, how they could slip back into this type of behavior so quickly after they had just had these remarkable reforms under Ezra and Nehemiah, and I was reminded of Mark Dabowski's sermon. He's been preaching through Ezekiel, and you remember what he said a few weeks ago, that when Ezekiel got his commission was, these people will not listen to you, but go tell them anyways. Remember, this is roughly the same time period. Now, Ezekiel was talking to the people in exile, but Ezra and Nehemiah are talking to the people who are back in the land. You don't see much difference between the way that the people had strayed after foreign gods and had neglected the worship of Yahweh and loving His law. And so you see kind of the same picture of the folks who are in exile and the people who are back in the land. So that's basically all we know about what was happening in the land. There is one more book, though, that's relevant to our study here. It's the last book of the Old Testament, which is Malachi. Malachi, as you know, is the final book of the Old Testament. And if you look on your handout there, you can see where I've put the box for the probable dates of Malachi. You can see that Malachi most likely overlapped with Ezra and Nehemiah's ministry. So somewhere in that time, circa 450 BC, Malachi was bringing his prophecies. And one of the things that's interesting to note is that when you read through Malachi, the emphases that Malachi is bringing in his prophecies are very similar to the things that Nehemiah and Ezra were dealing with. You see a lot of the same themes. For instance, in chapters 1 and 2 of Malachi, you see a corruption of the priesthood, which was something that was going on. We just saw how the priesthood was being corrupted when Nehemiah returned. Marriage to idolaters is covered in chapter 2 of Malachi, and that's what we just saw as well, the intermarriage. Abuse of the disadvantaged in chapter 3. And we've already seen that that was one of Nehemiah's reforms, was to fix, try to correct the abuse of the disadvantaged. And then failure to tithe is in the book, both in chapters 1 and in chapter 3 of Malachi. So you see that Malachi was addressing many of the same things that were going on in the land. And then finally, Malachi closes with two important themes that are picked up in the New Testament. And we kind of looked a little bit at this in our first week when we looked at the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. But there's two themes here. So in chapter 3 of Malachi, let me read just the first couple verses there. Malachi chapter 3. Let me read the first four verses here. See, I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me. Then suddenly the Lord you are seeking will come to his temple. The messenger of the covenant whom you desire will come, says the Lord Almighty. But who can endure the day of his coming? Who can stand when he appears? For he will be like a refiner's fire or a launderer's soap. He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. He will purify the Levites and refine them like gold and silver. Then the Lord will have men who will bring offerings in righteousness, and the offerings of Judah and Jerusalem will be acceptable to the Lord as in days gone by, as in former years. If you're like me, you can hear the Messiah ringing in there, the Handel's Messiah. That I always think of that. Who can endure the day of his coming? He will purify the sons of Levi. Anyways, there's two messengers here that we read about. I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me. And then later we have the messenger of the covenant whom you desire will come. So we've got two messengers here. One of those messengers is preparing the way for the Lord, and the other messenger is the messenger of the covenant who is coming in judgment, who will purify the sons of Levi. That is, he will purify them, the priesthood, in righteousness. And so we've got two messengers. And then when we go to the very end of the book in chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, we read these verses in the first week. See, I will send you the prophet Elijah before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, or else I will come and strike the land with a curse. Now, we looked in the first week at how those exact words are used in Matthew and in Luke of John the Baptist. And so, these are the final words of the Old Testament that we read here. And John, remember John now here, if we connect the messengers together here with Elijah, John is both the messenger who will prepare the way for the Lord, which we know of from the New Testament, and he's also the Elijah to come. So we see here that the messenger who is preparing the way for the Lord and the Elijah to come are the same individual, John the Baptist, which we learn from the New Testament. And so as we looked at in the first week, we know that the New Testament picks up exactly where the Old Testament left off. The very last verses of the Old Testament, when we look chronologically in Luke at the very first thing we read about in the New Testament, it's this very thing, the coming of John the Baptist, and the birth of John the Baptist, actually. So it's quite remarkable the way the Testaments dovetail together like that, even with the 400 and some year gap. But what we have here, if we just place ourselves, now we're going to be looking at the intertestamental period, so we want to sort of put ourselves in the position of the people who were reading this prophecy, and this is the last revelation that they had. So what kind of an ending is this to the Old Testament? It's a cliffhanger, really. It really is a cliffhanger. Where did it, in terms of the not being a pretty picture, where does it leave off? Well, we're left basically with this picture of continuing disobedience. That's where we're left off with at the end of the Old Testament. So we've seen Ezra and Nehemiah's correction of abuses. We've seen the slide back into serious disobedience during Nehemiah's absence. And that absence, by the way, is probably less than 10 years that severe decline happened. And then we have the final words of Malachi here, which are largely words of rebuke and an expectation of coming judgment. And then we've got these promises interweaved in here in chapters 3 and 4 of something that's yet to come, of a person that's yet to come, a messenger, someone who will prepare the way for the Lord, and then the Elijah to come. So we're kind of left with this cliffhanger ending. There's disobedience, there's promises of judgment, and then there's promises of a messenger to come. And that's it. That's where the revelation of God ends. And we're going to, you know, the New Testament picks up that story some 400 years later. But what we're going to do in the meantime is look at what happened in between those two points in time. So we're going to be getting now to the actual topic of the class, which is the intertestamental survey. Are there any questions or comments about where we're left with the Old Testament prior to picking up here in the next section? So the question is, when were especially the words of the prophets available to the people? Well, remember that these prophets were largely speaking to the people, first of all, and there was a lot of oral communication back then. So I think the word spread fairly quickly orally. In terms of when these books were written, I don't know exactly in terms of Malachi, but there is evidence that the Old Testament canon was being collected during this period of time. So, you know, we know the books of Moses were available and then a lot of the prophets. So it was really during the intertestamental period that the canon was being recognized and formed. That's probably not exactly how it happened. Same thing with the New Testament. Like, for instance, Paul's letters were floating around and being read by churches. They were being passed around hand to hand. And you don't find everything coming together as a completely recognize canon until much later. And the same thing happened with the Old Testament. Well, we're so far after and we've got it nailed down and established, which is a great advantage for us nowadays. I'm actually very interested in when this class ends, after the New Testament has picked up. So we're going to look at how this carries. This is literally months in the future because of the summer break. But hopefully in the fall, if we can finish this course, we'll finish up into the New Testament era. And I actually have on my outline that it completely lends itself to a discussion of the formation of the canon next. So I would like to do that next. I have written a paper on that and done some work on it. But sure. Right. That's a good question. So the question is, would everyone, whether they were in the land or in exile, have been aware of these messages either from Ezra and Nehemiah or from Malachi? And I think generally, yes. I confess that I didn't come prepared to know like even where Malachi was first originated, where I assume it was back in the land, but I'm not positive about that. We do know there was a lot of intercourse between, there was a lot of people traveling between. I mean, that's how Nehemiah heard that Jerusalem was in disrepair. We know that Jeremiah's letter was transmitted to the exiles, and we know that messages were passed the other way as well. So my guess is that, again, because of the oral tradition and the close community of Jews, that these messages would have been passed fairly quickly, you know, as short as it takes to make that trip, which, you know, we know in Ezra's case, something like 5 months, you know, to make that journey. But, I mean, the message that Malachi and that Ezra and Nehemiah were bringing was certainly known to everyone because it was a message of judgment. It was a message of you need to repent of your idolatry and return to obedience to the law. And so I'm sure that that message was crystal clear in both communities. And we had Ezekiel ministering in Babylon too, so you've had a lot of these themes going on from the prophets. Did you have a comment? Okay. Yeah, so just restating that because it was such a close-knit community and they had a religious calendar, they had regular meetings, they had Sabbath meetings, although we're just reading how the Sabbath was corrupted at this time. But the point is that they were getting together and they were communicating and they were probably still studying the law. So the message that these prophets were bringing was certainly known to the people. And we're seeing that as we listen to Mark Dabowski preach through Ezekiel, how that's really what Ezekiel's whole ministry was about, was getting that message out and actually acting it out in a lot of cases to the people, even though they wouldn't listen, as we heard. So we see that same picture, and that's where we left off at the end of the Old Testament. And so now we're going to go into the next section, which is a brief survey of the sources for the intertestamental period. My other handout here. So we're moving on to handout number 3. And what we'll do here is we're just going to hit the high points of how do we know about the intertestamental period? How do we know anything about it? It's not really covered in the Bible. And so how do we know about it and how trustworthy is the information that we have? So I've just kind of outlined a bunch of the sources here. What we'll do first is look at some of the literature, and then we'll look at some of the historians. So first of all, in terms of the literature, if you're looking at your handout, you probably already know, what's the only biblical source for the intertestamental period that we have? It's the book of Daniel. And so the interesting thing is that it's a source for the intertestamental period, but it was written before the intertestamental period. So in Daniel, we read about the fall of Babylon. I guess that was a contemporary reference. There we have the references to the Babylonian Belshazzar and the Persians, Cyrus and Darius. We also have the very interesting description and pictures of the successive world powers in those parallel visions in chapters 2, 7, and 8. That's on the back of your handout there. We're going to cover that in more detail when we get to the Persian period. It's in the back of your table handout. We've got that interesting successive world power parallel vision section. And then one part that's probably confusing to most of us, it always was to me, is all the political intrigue that's described in chapter 11 of Daniel, which is it's really the political intrigue that happened in the Diadochian period, which is called. It's really the post-Alexandrian era, where the Palestine was basically a battleground for all the political wars that were going on at that time. So Daniel actually gives us a lot of information about the period in these areas here, all in terms of prophecy, other than, of course, he was alive during the Persian period, through the Babylonian Persian period. And then in terms of other literature, we have the Apocrypha. We're going to be covering some of the literature here later. We've got a whole section on the literature of the period that comes towards the end of the course. But I just wanted to mention these here as sources for the intertestamental period. So we have the Apocrypha. And when you say Apocrypha, that means different things to different people. The word Apocrypha means those having been hidden away or hidden things. And it's come to mean for most of us probably, we're talking about the Old Testament Apocrypha, which is, you know, the Apocrypha that you would find in a Roman Catholic Bible, for instance, or even some Protestant Bibles. That's generally a collection of 15 books from the period 200 BC to roughly 100 AD. And it's usually 15 books, sometimes it's 14, sometimes it's 12, but it's all the same material. It just depends how you group the books together. So I generally talk about 15 books. Now, the reason I say it means different things to different people, Apocrypha can be used in a very specific sense to mean those books. It can also have a broader sense to just mean lots of the writings, hidden writings that happened in this period. And in that case, it would be a much broader application of the term. So if you're doing any reading on apocryphal literature, you'll find these 15 books, but you'll sometimes find lots of other books included as well. And other people put those books into different categories, which we'll talk a little bit more about in a minute here. So just beware, when you're talking about Apocrypha, when I always heard that term, I just assumed that's the books in the Roman Catholic Bible. It's not necessarily just that. But these books include a number of different genres. We've got historical works. We've got wisdom literature. We've got legendary material, which is sometimes called religious romances. And we've got prophetic material, which is also sometimes apocalyptic. Just like we do in the Bible, in the canon, we've got all of those, except for the legendary part. We've got historical books, we've got wisdom books, and we've got prophetic books, and apocalyptic as well, with the book of Revelation. So those are the genres that are within the Apocrypha. And in terms of our interest for the course here, these books give us historical information about the intertestamental period, first of all. For instance, the Maccabee books, 1st Maccabee especially, but also 2nd Maccabees, are historical recordings of the period and their primary source for the Maccabean period, which is part of the intertestamental period. And so there is good historical information in the Apocrypha. And then beyond that, the Apocrypha also provides a lot of background for understanding the New Testament in terms of the customs and the ideas and the expressions that are used there. So even if we're not just getting, this goes for all of the books in this period, even if we're not getting accurate historical information, we can get a lot of insight into the thinking of the period and what was happening. So it's valuable in that sense. And then the second group here that's sometimes referred to, and I don't even actually know how to say this, but it's pseudepigrapha. And you can hear pseudo in there. So pseudo means like, if we have a pseudonym, it's sort of a false name. And so it literally means false inscription. And what that refers to is the fact that many of these books are written under the name of a famous person, typically an Old Testament character. So you'll see that somebody has written a book under the name of somebody like Enoch, for instance, so that it will gain credibility and people will want to read it. You know, I guess it's kind of like putting the name of a famous author on a book today. But this is a wide collection of more than 60 titles, also kind of written in the same period, 200 BC to AD 200. Many of these books are very fanciful. If you read these materials, it's kind of a little bit wild. Fanciful, there's a lot of apocalyptic themes here. We're going to be looking at the whole apocalyptic area later on in the course because that's a theme of this period. There's a broad range of apocalyptic literature during this period that is often grouped under the pseudepigrapha category. And so it's very loose. The groupings are very loose here because not every book that's often included in here is actually a pseudo. It doesn't have like a false author. But it's kind of just a big collection point for literature. A lot of the apocalyptic writings, even if they're not true pseudepigrapha, are collected under this category. So the value of these books, too, there's not a lot of historical value here. There's not as much as, for instance, we have in the Book of Maccabees, in the books of Maccabees. But they do, again, provide a lot of insight into the Jewish thinking during the intertestamental period and leading up to the New Testament. And then I called out one specific book here. It's called The Letter of Aristeas. And this is actually part of the pseudepigrapha. Aristeas is considered to be a literary fiction. It's a lot of people refer to him as pseudo-Aristeas because they don't think that the guy's name was really Aristeas. But this one I called out is on its own because this is the one that has the legendary narrative describing how the Septuagint came to be translated in Alexandria back in the 200s BC. So this was a very important event that happened during this period, the translation of the Old Testament Hebrew scriptures into Greek in Alexandria, and that is known as the Septuagint. Septa, meaning it comes from the fact that the legend has it that 70 or 72 scholars translated it. And there's also further legends about the fact that it was done in 72 days and all this kind of stuff too, and it was without error. There's a whole legendary thing that grew up around that. LXX there, is that what I put in the handout? LXX is just the Roman numeral for 70. So you'll often see the Septuagint referred to as the LXX translation. And this letter tells this very interesting story about how this may have happened. There's probably elements of truth in it that tell us how it came to be translated under one of the Ptolemy rulers in Egypt. But again, it provides important insight into the lives of the Jews at the time. There was a big Jewish contingent living in Alexandria, Egypt at the time. And this, if you read through this letter, it provides a lot of insight into the lives of the Jews living in Alexandria in the 2nd century BC. And so this, I called that one out separately because it's kind of an important letter that deals with the Septuagint. And then finally, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls. And you probably know a little bit more about this because it's been in the news so much for the last 50 years. But this was thousands of documents and fragments that were recovered between 1947 and 1956 from the Wadi Qumran on the northwest corner of the Dead Sea in Israel, in Palestine. And these documents, it's been said it's one of the most remarkable manuscript discoveries ever. And we're going to talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls a lot more in under literature later, so I won't go into all the details here. But what is important as a source here is that these are the oldest, first of all, they're the oldest Hebrew Old Testament manuscripts that are in existence, literally 1,000 years earlier than anything we had before these were discovered. So it was a huge archaeological find. parts of all the Old Testament books except for Esther were discovered there. In some cases, full books. You know, we probably have heard about the famous Isaiah scrolls and things like that. And the one thing that was remarkable about the find is that even though they predated the Masoretic text, which is our Hebrew, the standard Hebrew text, even though they predated by like 1,000 years, the basic accuracy of the Masoretic text was completely confirmed. So it shows that the transmission of the Old Testament scriptures was very, very carefully copied over the years. And we're talking about 1,000 years and more in some cases, because they go back further than that. But you can see that the Hebrew Masoretic text, which often our Bibles are translated from, is very accurate, was found to be very accurate when compared to those ancient manuscripts. In the modern translations, there are actually changes that are made based on what has been found in the Old Testament manuscripts in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it's a whole interesting area that we can talk about later. Anyways, many of these documents, we've got, of course, Old Testament documents, but many of the documents shed light on the Jewish thinking in this time period. And this is very important because it's in the later period of the intertestamental period. It's really during leading up to the Roman period. And so this was when a lot of the Jewish sectarian groups, you know, we read in the New Testament, for instance, about the Zealots. That's probably related to this thinking here that was going on. And so there's some interesting documents that shed light on what was going on in Judaism and the thinking and practice during the later intertestamental period. So that's the literature that gives us insight into the intertestamental period. And with that, we're going to go into the historians. Are there any questions about that thus far? As I mentioned, we'll go through the Apocrypha, Pseudepigrapha, and the Dead Sea Scrolls in a lot more detail under the literature heading in the outline. Yes, Keith. So the question is, with the passing of time, was there a growing amount of skepticism, or were people even more expectantly looking forward to a deliverance, maybe? And there's probably a mixture of both, and you see that in some of the different parties. We know, for instance, like the Sadducees had grown up during this period, and we read about the Sadducees in the New Testament, who had basically didn't believe in a lot of the Old Testament doctrines, you know, like the resurrection of the dead and things like that. And so you see, I don't know if this is the right term, but a move towards liberalism, which is kind of skepticism, right? You know, like, this stuff isn't really true, and we're just going to align ourselves politically with the rulers of the day and just kind of go that way. On the other hand, you definitely see a big emphasis on this theme of an expectation that the Messiah is going to come yet, that... Yeah, right. So we've got groups like the Pharisees and who were strict adherents to the law, so they were trying to follow the law. You've got groups like the Qumran community, and some people think that the Qumran people were Essenes, which we read about in the New Testament, or in related to Zealots. All of those groups, I think, in general, had a strong looking forward aspect, you know, to that righteousness is going to be restored, that there's going to be a messianic figure that comes, and that they are going to be delivered. And therefore, they're redoubling their efforts to study the Old Testament scriptures, to live segregated lives of holiness, which was part of the Qumran folks. Right, and then you have what I would characterize as the true remnant of God's people, which we read about. We know that remnant existed. We know that people like Simeon and Anna and John the Baptist's parents, for instance, there's probably, just like in Elijah's time, there's probably thousands of people who were expectantly waiting for the Messiah and living lives of true holiness. So I think you had all those groups sort of mixed. But there is definitely and we'll see this when we look at the literature later, there's definitely a strong expectation of judgment coming, of a messianic figure, however that would be understood, and that the kingdom is coming. God is still coming to establish his kingdom. And you'll see, and a lot of that is tied to this rise in apocalyptic literature. So people were, they had the promises of the Old Testament. They knew where they were, and under, you know, successive political oppressions with, you know, no hope, no human hope of deliverance. And so they began to project more into the future, into this apocalyptic. That's where a lot of the apocalyptic literature arose from. They started projecting things into the future. So that's a good question, and that's certainly something that was going on. I think you had all of those strains, but the apocalyptic and messianic was fairly strong, which we'll see when we look at a little bit later. Apocalyptic means, I just think of the book of Revelation. So an apocalypse is, I guess, is a revelation of something that's given. And it's generally, apocalyptic genre would be like Revelation. It's sort of this figurative, prophetic view of the future, of things that are yet to come. Yeah, Ezekiel has some apocalyptic, Daniel has some apocalyptic themes in it, right? But yeah, just think of that kind of a literature. Okay, any other questions? All right, well, let's move into the historians. And so I've listed a number of historians, if you kind of look at your outline there. And the most important one is Josephus. And so we're going to cover him in a little bit more detail than the rest of the folks, because he is such an important figure in this period. If you read your study Bibles, the notes in your study Bibles, if you're reading commentaries, especially on the New Testament and the historical pieces, you'll often see footnotes that say something about Josephus. We learn this from Josephus. Or sometimes they won't say Josephus, they'll say tradition. We know from tradition that this happened or whatnot. The tradition that they're referring to is often Josephus. So when you see that word, that's where a lot of this information comes from. And so I think it's important. I always wondered who this guy was personally. And I know a little bit more about him now, so I thought it might be helpful to kind of go over his life and his writings a little bit, because he is such an important figure leading up to the New Testament. And so Josephus is a very important source for the intertestamental period, possibly the most important source. And he's a very interesting character. He lived, you can see from the dates there, he was born in AD 37. And so he was basically contemporary with the apostolic era, with the life of Paul, for instance. He would have been contemporary with Paul. So he lived through the war with Rome, and he gives eyewitness accounts of the war with Rome. He was a very careful historian of the Jewish people, and he sought to explain the Jewish religion. His main goal, I would say, was to explain the Jewish religion to the Gentiles, to the Romans in particular. And he's got four major works that we'll be talking about here after we look at his biography, and they're available in English. I grabbed this one from our library. It's The Life and Works of Josephus by Whiston. This is a really cool old book, you know, printed around the turn of the last century. Just you have to be careful when you say that now. You can see how big it is. He was a prolific writer, but this has four different works in it, two of which are pretty long, but it's very, very interesting to read. If you ever want to get sort of an expansion on anything, either in the New Testament or the Old Testament, or specifically the events in the intertestamental period, this is a very interesting book to read. And it's pretty well outlined. It's pretty easy to find things. They've got all the section headers about what is going to be covered in this section. So if you're ever interested in reading some of this stuff firsthand that you see in the notes in your study Bible, don't be scared off by the fact that it's this big. It's very easy to read, and it's very interesting. just don't have to read it cover to cover. You can just go read the parts that you're interested in. This is the copy that I own, and I found it very good. And we have this in our library. And there's actually two other Josephus books in there, which I think are more either abridgments or smaller versions. I think there's a more modern, critical edition of Josephus that's available as well. But this is the copy that I've used here, Whiston's translation. So in terms of his biography, we mentioned he was born in AD 37. He was born in Jerusalem into a wealthy priestly family, and he actually claimed to be descendant from the first high priest of the Hasmonean line, which was the priest Jonathan. The Hasmoneans, that's a term we'll hear a lot in the course. It's the Maccabean dynasty. It's usually called the Hasmonean dynasty. So if you hear Hasmonean, think Maccabean. We'll describe what all that means in a little while. So in his early life, most of this is taken from his autobiography. He was well-educated in rabbinic studies. He was very likely a bright scholar, very bright young man. He kind of has a little bit similarity to Paul, I think, if you think in terms of his learning and his really good mind. He claims that he was consulted by scholars on questions of Jewish law at the age of 14, which has led a lot of people to wonder if he's trying to claim something similar to Christ. There, you remember Christ talking to the folks in the temple, the priests in the temple. So some people have seen it. Josephus is trying to claim something for himself like that. But at any rate, he does appear to be a very bright scholar from a very early age. And at the age of 16, he tells us that he systematically went through and looked at all the major Jewish groups at the time to evaluate them. So he looked at the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Essenes to see which one of them was most closely following the Jewish life, the Jewish law and the Jewish life. And then he spent 3 years in the desert studying with a Jewish hermit. And then after that, he tells us at the age of 19 that he came back and he decided that he was going to become a Pharisee and that he had selected that as the best way to practice Judaism. And so he's a wealthy priestly descendant. He's very, very well educated, and he's become a Pharisee. And then, I'll skip over a lot of the stuff, but at the age of 26, this would have been in AD 63, he made a successful diplomatic mission to Rome, where I think he went to argue for somebody's release from prison, if I remember. But he went to see the emperor. Who was the emperor in 63 AD? Does anybody know? Who was the emperor in 63 AD? It was Nero. Okay, so you can connect the dots here. He was in Rome in AD 63, and he apparently made a very favorable impression on the emperor, and specifically on the emperor's wife. Nero's wife really liked him. So just look at the timing there, 63, just to calibrate you. What's going on about that period of time? Persecution, and specifically Paul's ministry. So this event would have occurred during the later part of Paul's ministry, and it probably just after Paul was released from prison. So probably, therefore, near the close of the book of Acts. So just think in terms of contemporaneity here. Josephus is in Rome. He may have been in Rome the same time Paul was in Rome in prison. So that's kind of setting where things are going. He had a lot of military experience. I think we'll close with this. He had direct military experience during the Jewish revolt against Rome. So this happened a little bit later. He tells us that he tried to remain neutral in the conflict with Rome, but he was sort of commandeered and became the commander of a fortress in Galilee named Jotapata. And so in AD 66 now, this is right at the beginning of the Jewish revolt against Rome, he was made commander of this fortress. And apparently, this is where his life gets a little bit controversial. He apparently made a vow of resistance to death in a suicide pact with the Jews in the fortress. But then he didn't keep it. He surrendered to Rome. And so this was one of the things that labeled him as a turncoat by a lot of Jewish people of the day. But he did surrender to the Roman. He apparently impressed the Roman general Vespasian now. That general Vespasian was in charge of going and restoring order in Palestine. And he had his son along with him later, Titus. But apparently, when he was captured, he predicted that Vespasian would become the emperor, which he did become the emperor at a later time. But Josephus impressed the Romans, and so even though he was a captive at this point in time, he had made a favorable impression on the Roman government, which is going to be very important for him later in life. So I think next week we'll finish off Josephus's life, and we'll go through some of his writings, and that'll probably take us to the end of next week.